The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast. Friday, the 13th of December, 2019. On the podcast today, we have Executive Chairman of Extract Resources, ticker XDR, Colin Bird. Talks about an update there, as well as Russ Molt, Investment Director at AJ Bell. We talk a little bit about the election result, as well as his macro thoughts at the moment. Finally on the podcast, we have Alan Green, where he talks about four stocks.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Joining me on the podcast today, I have Colin Bird from Extract Resources. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Just for investors who aren't aware of the company and what you do there, could you give a brief introduction to Extract?
Yeah, Extract is involved in both copper and gold. Its countries which it is working in are Mozambique and Zambia. It's a mixture of low-scale alluvial production, which is developing into hard rock production and dump retrievement. And it has three key exploration projects, major exploration projects in Zambia. And that really is our portfolio. It's listed on AIM, got a market cap of about £4.5 million. Current share price of about a penny.
Amazing. And what is your take on the election result, and what are the implications, in your view, on the mining industry, in particular the smaller miners?
Well, isn't it nice? You know, we're in a situation now where I guess Brexit's behind us. It'll take Boris, I don't think, much later than the end of January to get that one sorted out. And of course, there are lots of other situations which have had no attention over the last couple of 3 years, like people being stabbed in the street, like an NHS, which is under pressure, like an education system. So there's some real issues at home that with a majority like that, he'll be able to address. But in terms of our industry and in terms of industry and business in general, commerce in general, what a good result. What a good result. Because I think you know as well as I do, the biggest killer in the investment industry is uncertainty. At least that is gone. And that, you know, the pound's really belting ahead. So, you know, it really, I think, is a bit of a feel-good factor in London now. And once we get over the euphoria, some hard work to be done. But I think it can only be beneficial to our industry and business in general.
Mm. Speaking of your business, how are your projects progressing? Can you give us an update?
Well, everything's online. Manika, you know, the hard rock project is advancing to our deal with Horizon Mining, where we get 23% of the 23% of the income. And that's on budget, on schedule. The alluvials are producing. At Kalengwa, we've done a stack of test work. We've approached it from every single angle. That's the Zambian copper project, the dumps. And we've arrived at a solution which we feel is the best solution when one takes all the parameters into consideration, parameters like getting into production, an operation which doesn't need an awful lot of power, an operation which is job creative and fits the environment. So we satisfied all the parameters, and now we're into detailed costing and to the point of optimizing reagents and flows, etc. So that's going very well. And we're drilling. We're drilling at Matrix. And when we're done with Matrix, we'll go over to Eureka. And from there, we'll go to Kalengwa, because we're pretty confident of extending that pit a few hundred meters in each direction. So all in all, it's tough at the moment. It's hard work. And next year, it ain't going to be any better. We really have got to get heads down and get these projects up and running. So, but the summary is a mixture of production, potential production, exploration, on budget, on track. So we're excited about next year.
Indeed. And I do want to ask you, yesterday you released news regarding Nexus and the agreement there. What can you tell us about that?
Well, they advised us on the 2nd of December that we're terminating the agreement. Shot out of the blue, their decision. But the net effect of that is that we get 100% of the profits, the income. Of course, we have to pay 100% of the cost, but we get 100% of revenue. So in actual fact, whatever comes out of those alluvials, the benefit of extract multiplied by two. So it's double. In effect, it's doubled our earnings.
Amazing. And there has been some speculation about the Colengua development. Can you comment on that?
Yes, indeed. I mean, you know, that do we own it? Of course we don't own it. KPZ own it. And we're in joint venture with KPZ. And our initial due diligence confirmed that they do own it. They're the rightful owners. We've checked with the appropriate senior people in the ministries who have confirmed that. And I think we advised the market that it was confirmed. So, quite frankly, the speculation, I think, is just gossip for gossip's sake.
Right. And what is your general prognosis on metal prices, particularly the ones that you're involved in?
Well, you know, I think we're in the right metals, aren't we? I think copper went over 6,000 the other day. Gold, you know, we've got the, we've got those speculators who were saying, look for $2,000 gold. I don't think I'm going to lie awake expecting $2,000 gold, but you know, it's not unreasonable to expect $1,500-$1,600. But you know, stability around the price we're at is pretty good for our operations in Manica, and I'll be very, very happy if gold prices stay where they are, and I think we can stand a wee bit of downside. In fact, we test all the way down in terms of break even. We test all the way down to $600 with both our alluvials and our hard rock. But you know, God forbid we go there. And just as an aside, that our hard rock is protected all the way down. It's just a sliding scale between 1250 and 1100. So all in all, to answer your question, we feel good about gold. And I think I'm recognized as a copper bull. I feel extremely bullish on the fundamentals for copper, which, of course, assuming, and one should assume, that the China-US tension is eased a little, that can only be good for most of the base metals as well, particularly copper. So, yes, in summary, feel good about the metals we're in and the prognosis for next year.
Amazing. Thank you, Colin. And as always, could I ask, could you give us three reasons why investors should be following Extract Resources very quickly?
Well, you're looking at two units coming in, producing independently in two countries, gold and copper, by the middle of next year. So if you price us forward, a penny for 5 million, £4.5 million market cap looks extraordinarily cheap. If you look at the blue sky exploration, any one of our projects can actually come up with a very good result. If I was to favour one, Eureka, I would favour. And we're active in Zambia, central and northwest Zambia, looking for much of the same. So I'm very bullish for the sector. I'm bullish for the commodities. And I'm bullish for the company in its position relative to all of those things. I think that's probably about five reasons. I apologize for that. But difficult when you really believe and you're excited about the prospects to iron it down to just a couple of parameters or three parameters.
Yeah. Colin, well, thank you very much for your time. Hopefully catch up with you in the not too distant future.
That's very kind. Happy Christmas and a good new year.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Joining me on the podcast today, I have Russ Mould, who's Investment Director at AJ Bell. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Pleasure, Abraham. Good to catch up.
First of all, I just want to get your take on the election night. What do you think?
I guess, you know, markets had been taking their lead from the opinion polls, which were predicting a conservative victory, and the polls have been proven correct. I mean, I guess the most violent initial move was in sterling, which reached a 19-month high on the dollar and a three-year high on the euro. And that's then been reflected in the action in the equity market, where the FTSE 250, the sort of more domestically slanted index, is outperforming the 100. I mean, the FTSE 100's up around 1% in a bit as I look at my screen, but the 250 is up 4% and more. And I guess there are two themes here. One is sterling, you know, sort of, I guess its decline increased the value of overseas assets and earnings. So now its increase is sitting on those a little bit and reining those in. So that's not so good for the multinationals, the dollar earners. And But the other theme is what you are seeing is a dash today, at least. And in fact, it's been going on for 3 or 4 months for value stocks, for cyclical growth. And you're seeing sort of the quality stocks, which have really dominated for the last 10 years, let alone the last 3 years, are lagging. So you're seeing banks, house builders, some retailers doing particularly well. And what you're seeing lag are names like Reckitt Benckiser, like Diageo, like the pharmaceuticals, like Relics, the academic publisher. And this is interesting because, you know, we've seen value start to outperform growth 3 or 4 months ago. Is this market's pricing in a return to cyclical growth because of a renewed interest rate cut regime around the world, because governments are promising an end to austerity, including this new Conservative government? Johnson and Javid have said they will increase spending. Okay, not as much as Corbyn and McDonnell would have done, but there's a you know, you've got the US running huge fiscal stimulus. Korea has done so. Japan has just launched a fiscal package. So are markets pricing in, not just in the UK's case, a resolution to the Brexit lock, the Brexit blockage, but a wider move for stimulative fiscal and monetary policy? And if you think that is the case, then you don't need to pay really high multiples for growth from tech and from quality names, when in theory there'll be lots of cyclical growth lying around in the street at much cheaper multiples. So that's possibly the longer term story. The short term story is the market was clearly more frightened of Mr. Corbyn than it was of Brexit. Now, whether you agree with it or not, that's just the way it's looking today. So you're seeing a bit of the sterling effect on 100 versus 250. And then longer run, is this the start of something more pro-growth, pro-inflation? Well, let's find out.
What is your take on sort of the long-term prospects for the pound? Do you see any more upside?
Oh, Abraham, my record on calling sterling is absolutely appalling. Anything I say, people will immediately do the opposite. Probably proven completely correct. I think the pound has clearly been depressed by uncertainty over Brexit. And Mr. Johnson still has to deliver. He wants to get it done, but we've still got the transition deadline by December 2020, which Johnson has said he will not look to extend. Now, I admit his record on saying one thing and then doing something else has been well documented. But nevertheless, that's the official stance. And so we will quickly get back to a stage where markets will look and actually think, oh, crumbs, the clock's ticking again. Because, although, you know, remember, you know, markets have been frightened of a no deal or a hard Brexit. They don't view it as a positive just because they don't know what it means in terms of the economy. So if the EU, the early EU discussions start to go badly or to break down, then it's possible that will again weigh on the pound. I think fundamentally the UK economy is still in a slightly difficult place. Although the budget deficit is down to 2% of GDP, the aggregate deficit is still 85% of GDP. And we've got a government that's now talking about increasing spending without necessarily increasing taxes. If anything, it's cutting the threshold for national insurance contributions. And we run a current account and trade deficit that would embarrass a banana republic. So the fundamentals of the UK economy is still quite fragile. That's why Mr. Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, is there saying, you know, as we're dependent upon the kindness of strangers, people funding our economy by, you know, selling us lots of things and lending us money. So I think that the fundamentals of the pound are still somewhat questionable. But I could see why it's rallying in the short term. But if there's no Brexit deal on the horizon, you could see it come under pressure again quite quickly.
I do want to get, you know, the focus has been around the election, obviously. But I do want to get your 2 cents early in the week. The Fed decision. Did you watch that? What did you think of that?
I did. Well, it was a bit of a knot. I mean, I guess it was one of those things, again, that had been widely expected that they would do nothing at the December meeting. I think, to be fair, their view that they will now do zero in 2020 and let things develop, I think was less dramatic than markets had expecting. Markets had been pricing in anywhere between 1 and 4 interest rate cuts next year. So the Fed is saying none. Okay, to be fair, it entered this year saying it would do 2 or 3 and actually did 2 or 3 increases and actually did 2 or 3 cuts. So events can take a hand. I think I understand where they're coming from. I think the pressure to cut will be relieved if there is a US-China trade deal. But who knows? We've been waiting for that for a year already. And the pressure to cut will be relieved if the US economy, you know, keeps performing relatively strongly. You can make a case for the US economy going fine. Employment is high, unemployment is low, but and consumer confidence is very high. Equally, the lead indicators like the PMIs aren't great, the yield curve is still very flat. You're seeing weakness in freight numbers and truck orders, which isn't good. So some of the more leading and concurrent indicators aren't so good, even if the lagging ones like employment are. But the Fed at the moment feels that it's kind of got things in hand. And the markets like that. The markets like to think that central banks know and think that they're in control. And there is still plenty of cheap money around. And also, don't forget, the Fed is pumping huge amounts of money into this interbank funding market, this repo market that got out of control in September. There's a big story in the pink paper today, the FT, that they're actually increasing their funding commitment to that. Why? And it's not a great sign. Personally, it would lead to me to think that there's a bank out there or a company out there that people that uses the overnight funding market that people don't want to lend to, which feels like a little bit like systemic risk, which isn't great. But markets aren't taking that view. It's much more, oh, good, lots of more cheap money, lovely. And that's one of the reasons why we're having this big run into the year end, plus hopes for a trade deal between America and China. But, you know, hope isn't a strategy. So at the moment, we're climbing the wall of worry. We think markets think the Fed's got everything under control. Markets think that Trump's going to deliver a deal. So they'd better do, or we're going to start sliding down the slope of hope. But at the moment, it's everybody seems to think they're going to get the best possible scenario.
And speaking of central banks, what do you think of the European central banks?
Well, Christine Lagarde, I've got to be careful what I say. I mean, her last major act at the IMF was to lend $57 billion to Argentina, which doesn't look so smart now, does it? So I think in that respect, you know, we all get things wrong. So it's easy to be a smart aleck, but that doesn't look so good. It's very clear that she's not a hawk. I mean, she's slipped, you know, she's accepted the Draghi policies. She clearly isn't going to change those. And she's talking much more actively about green bond investment and pushing European governments towards greater fiscal laxity and towards spending more money. So she certainly isn't a hawk by any means, which is fascinating, given that the IMF is generally what it will do. It will turn up, lend somebody some money, and then impose this incredibly strict fiscal regime. Well, obviously, it's, you know, one set of treatment for the developing markets, and actually we're a developed market, so we'll play by our own rules, which don't involve the ones we force on you, which I view as a bit two-faced personally. So I think she's there, definitely monetary laxity, and seems to be pressing for fiscal laxity. So again, she's going to be seen as pro-growth, pro-action, which after 10 years of low growth, no growth, a lot of people are looking forward to, but it does have portfolio implications, because if we do get cyclical growth aplenty for whatever source with a bit of inflation thrown in, what's worked over the last 10 years, bonds, long duration, particularly long duration bonds, but long duration assets like tech stocks and so on, they aren't going to work in the next 10 years. So it could be an interesting pivot point for markets if these policies are implemented and if they start to work. I think they will be implemented. The Japanese example would suggest that they don't work. But as an American friend pointed out to me the other day, why do you keep banging on about Japan? Yes, it hasn't worked there. But, you know, whenever any other countries have printed money and gone on tax and spent and on spending, it has created inflation. Maybe Japan's the outlier, the exception that proves the rule.
Amazing. Well, Russ, do you have any final thoughts for investors thinking about UK stocks at the moment?
Well, I think you can easily make a case that the UK is value. It's underperformed certainly over the last 3 years, if not for most of the last 10. It's unloved because you've seen fund flows out of UK equities consistently for the last 3.5 years. And underperformed and unloved can mean undervalued. And, you know, on 12 times forward earnings with a yield of over 4.5%, it's cheap relative to its history. It's cheap relative to its international peers. But what you obviously need is a catalyst. And whether that, and that is probably really a bit of growth, a little bit, but please goodness, not too much inflation. A little bit of growth, and that might be the thing. The UK is a relatively cyclical market. It's very heavily exposed to banks, to oils, to miners, consumer discretionary to a degree. It's got a good ballast of consumer staples, but it's quite a cyclical market. It's quite global in terms of the 100 at least. So a bit of global growth probably wouldn't do the UK any harm, all things considered. But what you don't want is too much inflation. It's a little bit like, I forget who it was. Was it St. Augustine? Said, oh, Lord, please give me chastity, but not just yet. It's a little bit like you want some inflation, but not too much. Because if you go back to the 70s, and obviously the conundrum now is central banks can't start inflation, whereas in the 1970s, they couldn't stop it. And ironically, this is the week when Paul Volcker, the man who took over the Fed and did beat inflation and did rein it in from 20% down to, you know, much more moderate levels in the early 1980s in the US.
Yeah.
The week that he's died, you know, you are seeing more and more central bankers like Lagarde, you know, talk about going the other way and going for policy to try and create inflation that they crave and yet can't generate. So it's interesting. And if you go back then to the 70s, you know, we all think, oh, a little bit of inflation would be good for equities. Yes, maybe, but you don't want too much. And you got far too much in the 1970s when equities, okay, they went up, but they didn't beat inflation. Bonds got killed, cash got killed. Mm. And the only place that you really needed to be was the shiny yellow metal stuff, which has done quite well this year, but has now hit a wall at 1500 because people have gone back to thinking that central banks are in charge. So, you know, they've got, yes, a little bit of inflation, please, but not too much. So be careful what we wish for.
Yeah, it's an interesting turn of events, absolutely. Well, Russ, thank you very much for taking
it's
the time to talk.
It's an absolute pleasure, my friend. Have a great weekend and we'll speak soon, I hope.
Yes, I hope so too. Thank you very much. Cheers.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Welcome to the podcast. Today I have Alan Green, who's going to talk to us about four companies. What do you have for us today?
Hi, Adrian. Abraham, very good morning. Wanted to touch on several developments this week amongst concerning companies that I have spoken with Justin about on the podcast recently, but some key developments indeed. First one, there was a big announcement this week, and in fact one out this morning from Cadence Minerals, Epicode KDNC. I just want to talk about Cadence because I believe this company is fundamentally undervalued right now, and I'm going to tell you why. So it's currently worth the Epicode KDNC shares are traded as high as 48p on the year, currently trading at just over 8p. With a market cap of just under 8.5 million. Now, that market cap is asset backed because Cadence is a mining investment company and it invests in strategic minerals and metals in projects around the world that are at various phases of development. So its strategy is to invest early stage and then get out once it's once the project gets close to production or moves on from there and then reinvest in another project. So, the company is asset-backed by investments in European Metals Holdings, which owns the Sinovec lithium project in Czechoslovakia. It has 19.1% of that company, which is currently valued at $25 million, so Cadence Tech is worth about $5 million. MacArthur Minerals, it owns 7.5%, and there was an announcement this morning, which I'll touch on shortly. The market cap of that company is about $21 million, so again, 7.5% of that. Also has 30% of the Yangibana project were on free carry. That's operated by Hastings Technology Metals, which is an ASX listed company, has a market cap of some 150 million. So straight away there, just on the assets alone, on those three assets alone, we've got valuations which I believe massively exceed Cadence's existing valuation. Early this year, Cadence announced that it was changing tack and investing into a defunct mine in Brazil. It's called the Amapa Iron Ore Project. Now, the Amapa Iron Ore Project is interesting on a number of levels because it was owned and operated by Clough's and also Anglo American back in the early noughties. And in 2012, Anglo-American valued their stake in Amapa, and that's the mine, the port at Santana, and also the railway to transport the ore to the port. Valued the project at $462 million, $600 million of its total valuation. Cadence have received judicial approval to restart the mine, but on a number of conditions. They had to vest $2.5 million with the state of Amapa, and that $2.5 million, when it's released, will go to pay some of the creditors for the mine, which is currently not operating. It announced on Monday it had received rail concessions. That is to say, they can reopen the railway to transport iron ore tailings to the port of Santana. Massively significant. There are two steps. The next step is to receive approval from the state of Amapa to release security over the Amapa mine. When that happens, the $2.5 million go to pay the creditors. Cadence can then start to sell $60 million worth of tailings, which are waiting at the port to be shipped. And as we know, there's been a spike in the iron ore price recently. So iron ore is in demand. And previously, when Anglo was operating this, the iron was sold all over the world into China and was marked as a very high grade. At this point, Cadence will own 20% of the Amapa project. Now, it doesn't take a genius mathematician to work out what 20% of a mine that was once valued at $600 million is worth. They have estimated it'll take some $168 million to recommission the mine. $60 million from the sale of the tailings will go into that. And they estimate they'll be back to new production as early as 2022. So this is hugely significant for Cadence Minerals. And In the announcement on Monday, the chairman, Andrew Suckling, who's very highly regarded throughout the mining industry as an expert on metals and an expert metal trader, he is the chairman of the company, and he said he believed that the Amapa mine would be a company-changing event for Cadence. So I think at this point, It's not going to happen overnight, but there is a very strong investment case for Cadence, given that you've also got the spread of risk with the other projects too. And indeed, this morning, there was an announcement from one of its investee companies, MacArthur Minerals, that it had intersected high-grade magnetite at its Lake Jones iron ore project in Australia. So that encapsulates the Cadence investment case. Have you got any thoughts or questions on that for me, Abraham?
Yeah, what do you think the market is seeing in terms of risk with the iron project that you mentioned?
Well, I don't think there has been any reaction. I think what will happen, I think the market will respond and react to the Amapa project once the state of Amapa releases security on the mine, because then the company can get to work on the mine. It will have backers that will come in that where it can raise money from institutions to recommission the mine. It's now got the permissions to run the railway and also basically get the port back up and working as well, which will take $168 million. Once that's happened, Cadence estimates that it's going to be producing $266 million worth of sales per annum with EBITDA of $136 million. So that's pretty significant by any standards. So we have Cadence here with a valuation of $8.5 million. I believe once we get to the next stage, which is the release of security, we will see things start to move. And Cadence is set for a very exciting couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt the asset looks really exciting. What do you think the major obstacle is for Cadence and for the mine to be reinstated?
Well, I think in a sense they've already got over the fact that they now have the permissions, or that they have the critical rail concessions awarded to them. That is a massive step, and it's not just the, I mean, clearly the commercial potential of the mine is there for all to see, but this is going to massively regenerate the Amapa region. It's going to create hundreds of jobs. There's going to be investment into infrastructure, into schools, hospitals. It's going to have a massive effect on the community because it will create all these new jobs. So this is something that the state of Amapa will very much want to see, and I think that first step's already occurred, but clearly once the security is released, I believe that'll be a threshold event for the valuation and for how the market sees the potential going forward. Clearly with anything of this size, that they're always going, that there will be unforeseen hurdles to cross, but I know the Cadence board have been working on this since spring this year, and particularly since the summer. They've been working with the Amapa governor and state officials to get this over the line. So if you look at the announcement on the brand website, there are quite a few pictures and photographs taken of the local governor with officials from the region, signing the release of the road concessions and everything else. So, you know, this isn't a small fry mine by any standards. This is a massive, massive project, and clearly it'll need recommissioning. But once it's up and running, given the demand for iron ore, and particularly given the Vale Dander's Arch as well, which has squeezed the iron ore price. I think we're set for a very exciting couple of years.
Mm. And so once the government does give the green light, you know, that'll be an inflection point, do you think?
I do believe that'll be an inflection point, yes. And clearly, you know, the team have been down there since the summer, and the negotiations are ongoing. But I think, given that we've got the rail concessions over the line, excuse the pun, at this stage, the next part can't be too long in following. But you know, clearly that's it's not for me to say when that will happen.
Yeah. What else are you following at the moment, Alan?
Okay, so on Monday we've been following Open Orphan for some time, and you've had Cal Friel on the podcast and discussing the developments. And I like Cal and his team, and I like him because he's straight talking, and he does what it says on the tin, basically. So quick recap: Open Orphan, as we know, are an orphan drugs company. 2018, over 50% of US FDA approved drugs were orphan drugs, and it's a difficult area because orphan drugs treat rare diseases. There's a lot of cost in developing them, and it's quite broadly spread, and it's a disparate environment at the moment for developers. So what Orphan are doing is they're consolidating companies into, as we said, it's a fragmented sector. They've developed a virtual rep platform which enables pharma companies and key opinion leaders and physicians to engage, and it's growing the health database, which is a platform that collects data. That data is estimated to be worth up to £3,000 per patient. Recently, the company signed a preferred partner agreement with Ipsen Group, which is a massive company, and that was a big step forward. But on Monday, as I say, it announced a reverse takeover of hVIVO, which it has an awful lot of synergies with. It's given an uplift to Vivo shareholders of some 34%. Valuation is 15.6p, and Vivo holders will get 2.47 orphan shares for each share they own in Vivo, and the Vivo shareholders will have 44.5% in the enlarged entity that is the new Orphan Vivo company. Vivo has a huge database of patients, and it's taken time to develop and commercialize them, but the synergies are there, Cal said, to commercialize the Vivo database through the Open Orphan platform, which I covered just now. It massively broadens the in-house clinical offering, and obviously when two companies come together, you look at the operating costs, you look at the operating synergies, there are an awful lot on the table there. So right when Orphan evolved from Venn Life Sciences in the summer, Cal said that they would have another acquisition done and dusted by the end of the year, and he's delivered that. He's not only delivered on that, but he's also delivered on a series of partner agreements. And clearly, you know, Orphan now is currently trading with a valuation pre-merger valuation of some 13 million. And again, there is a huge amount of upside here. I think the strategy of bringing these smaller pharma companies together where there are synergies is a great idea. And growing this database, which is extremely valuable, gives the company a great deal of collateral value going forward.
What do you think of the market reaction to the merger?
I think the problem is at the moment that we're in an environment, and clearly where we are here in Europe, we have Brexit, which is paralysing an awful lot of activity and investor interest at the moment, and it's the market reaction has been muted. But I think again, it's often the way when a company is blazing a trail and it has a strategy, it's sometimes hard to articulate that strategy into the market. The best way for Open Orphan to proceed with this is to start delivering and to start delivering value to the bottom line. And that obviously comes down to earnings and cash generation. And once that happens, then I think the market will respond. But any merger like this, it's sometimes hard to take on board the synergies. Cal and his team have been working with Trevor since the summer to get this one over the line, and clearly they have a raft of synergies which you can explain in a long document, but sometimes you've got to break it down into simple bullet points, and I think that's something that's hard to do. But certainly what they've said straight away is that the Vivo database will be commercialized, that process will be accelerated through the open orphan platform, and the combined offering is massively broadened. In other words, the sum of the two will be greater than the parts.
Absolutely. And in that same announcement, he invested 2.5 million of his own money through his investment firm. What do you think of that?
Exactly. And again, I mean, we talk so much about directors having skin in the game. And Cal is that's one of the reasons, I think a lot of people got a great deal of respect for Cal, myself included, is that, you know, he backs his judgment with his own money. And when you do that, and you know he's got a lot of charisma as chairman and CEO, you know, he's a guy with a vision. He sees how he can take this forward. He sees how he can execute. But not only that, when he says he'll do something, he does it. And so far he's ticked all the boxes. I think he's in a tough market at the moment, given where we are with Brexit. But I think as we go into the new year, once we start to see the synergies of the merger hitting the bottom line, you'll see the share price accelerate. Of course, the value will out then.
Mm. So, Alan, what other companies are you looking at the moment?
Okay, wanted to touch on Kibo Energy. Now, Kibo, of course, are that they have a number of projects. They have projects in Africa, in Botswana, which are coal to power projects, and they also have a UK energy project in conjunction with Mast Energy Developments called Bordsley, and it's a 5 megawatt gas fuel power generation plant, The company has been working on this and developing this for some time with AB Impianti, the Italian company, and there was an announcement again yesterday. The company said that it was making good progress towards de-risking the plant, the plant remains on target for commercial commissioning at the end of quarter one 2020, which is basically 3 months away. So we've got a power and energy company and a mining company which has got a raft of opportunities, and sits there now with the possibility of generating revenues into its onto the bottom line as early as March next year, you know, which for me is very exciting. And the company recently raised a sum of money to further the projects and get the projects over the line, but we've got here a market cap of just 5.5 million, and the shares have traded as high as 2.6p, currently trading at 0.4p. So I think once Bordsley is commissioned, we start to see sales from that plant into the electricity network, then I think we're going to see a re-rating for Kibo shares.
Amazing. And I believe you have one more company that you're following at the moment as well.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, I just want to touch on this. There's been a lot of speculation, and I wanted to touch on this company. I'm invested in this company too. Bidstack PLC, BIDS is the EPIC code. The shares are traded just below 40p on a high of the year, as low as 4.2p, currently at 15.5p. Bidstack have developed a proprietary technology for gaming, and the gaming market, as we know, is absolutely huge. It's currently growing at 13-14% per annum, currently worth many billions of dollars, and this is a market that really hitherto has been untapped for advertisers. but Bidstack have developed, and they've had all the major advertising agencies and the major gaming platforms testing it. They developed a platform to serve advertising onto games. So for example, you're playing a football game, the hoardings on the side of the pitch. So if you're watching, say, Spurs play Man United, you'll see all the hoardings on the side of the pitch with the advertising running present. You'll see a similar thing on the gaming platform that you're playing in, or you'll see, I don't know, if you're an action game, you'll probably see banners on the side of the buildings that you're attacking lit up, and they'll be serving ads according to your gaming profile. So it's an exciting technology, and I think some investors were caught short by the interim results earlier in the year, which generated a very modest amount of money. But James Draper is the CEO. He said they're building Bidstack to become the biggest media owner in the video games market. The team has undertaken an incredible amount of work this year so far. He said then quarter four is all about execution on our previous work, and by execution on the previous work he's intimating that they will be earning to earn money from the network that are using the platform and using the channels that they've created. The Bidstack platform is also endorsed by a number of major sort of figures in the gaming industry. He's brought an awful lot of people into an advisory committee, people from Spotify, from Trade Desk, have come in on this advisory committee. And the big advertising agencies currently sell, of course, digitally. They're selling to TV, into radio, into press. The gaming sector is a brand new area. They've not really sold into this before. So what Bidstack potentially have done is open up a whole new dimension to a multi billion pound spend every year for advertisers. And it's very exciting. And they've undergone a great deal of testing this year. We know about the testing, about the validation by independent agencies. They've gone through all these hoops, and now, as James said, it's all about quarter four. It's all about execution on the work, revenues being generated from the work that they've undertaken. So I think they've been quiet for a couple of months, so we're due some sort of update in the not too distant future. So I, for one, as a shareholder, am very excited to see where they're at.
What do you think about the reaction to their partnership with Dentsu, who are a huge advertising network? It just came before their interims, but
It did, and again, just refer to what I was saying just now, validation. So Dentsu are a huge advertising network, and that for me cemented their credibility in the international in the advertising community globally. If you've got Dentsu on board, you've got a partnership with Dentsu, then you're pretty well 56 to 60% of the way there. So that's great. They've been working with Dentsu, and I think it's that for me was the biggest stamp of credibility the company's received to date. So with this advisory committee and the steering committee that's helping them develop and taking it to all the right places, I think 2020 is going to be a seminal year for Bidstack.
So the only question remains now is can they deliver on the revenues, and can they use this partnership and use that board to actually generate revenues?
Of course. I was having a conversation with someone about this the other day, and somebody said to me, well, so if you're gaming, I don't game online. That's not my bag. But my son does, and I see these people sort of gaming with thousands of people online, and all of those people with the Bidstack network disseminated through there, we'll be seeing different ads according to their profile, which is very exciting. But in we're subjected to advertising, whatever we watch. If we watch a film now, you've got product placement in the film, so you'll see advertisements appear in the film. It's subliminal stuff, it's brand building, and this will be the same. This will be the same sort of platform. So if you're playing in a city and you're fighting a battle in the city with several thousand other gamers, you'll be seeing you might be seeing Coca-Cola ads here and there, and that's subliminal branding. So this is the level that Bidstack are now at, and I think the validation for this model is every bit as strong as product placement in product placement on TV series, product placement on films, and so on. To me, it makes absolute sense. Hitherto, there hasn't been the technology to deliver it, and Bidstack have now brought that technology to the global advertising marketplace.
Cool. Alan, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on the podcast today. It was great to have you on.
Thanks, Abraham. Good to be on.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And as always, the five most followed companies on Vox Markets today are, starting with number five, United Oil and Gas, ticker UOG. Number four, Zibao Metal Recycling Holdings, PLC, the ticker is ZBO. At number three is Tullow Oil, ticker TLW. The second most followed company is Oriole Resources, ticker ORR. And the most followed company on Vox Markets today is Oracle Power, PLC, the ticker is OCP. And the most liked RNSs in Vox Markets today are, starting with number five, Hurricane Energy, ticker HUR. They've got a trading, operational, and license update. At number four comes from Codemasters Group. They've got Fast and Furious Crossroads as their new licensed IP. At number three is Immu Pharma, where they've announced a dual listing on the Euronext Growth in Brussels. And at number two, Extract Resources, XTR, where they've updated on their alluvial collaboration agreement. At number one is United Oil and Gas, where they've completed the sale of their North Sea blocks.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.